Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. ExxonMobil's May 26th annual shareholders meeting began, as such meetings usually do.
Welcome to our 2021 annual shareholders meeting. Darren Woods, ExxonMobil's Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, will preside over the formal meeting and will also provide a business review and address questions as time permits.
I know your eyes are glazing over already, but don't let them, because then this normally placid shareholders meeting turned into an extraordinary battle over the future of one of the world's largest energy companies. CEO Darren Woods has led the $255 billion company since January of 2017, and he wanted to keep his current board of directors, which he called, quote, one of the best in the corporate world. But along comes an upstart hedge fund called Engine Number One. It owns only 0.02% of Exxon stock.
In the world of investing, it was an ant. Engine Number One is like a tiny ant. You can barely see them. But they put together and executed a masterful plan, and they won.
And that's Eric Gordon, business professor at the University of Michigan. And the victory he's talking about is the fact that Engine Number One put forward an alternative slate of board members, one focused on a future for the company based on renewable energy. Now, Exxon has been trying to, quote, fight off the future for as long as possible, Charles Penner, one of the principals at Engine Number One, said. Change is coming.
The trajectory has to start bending now. Change can happen anywhere. It will always be a long shot, but it will always be worth it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Charlie. Let me respond by first stating that we value the constructive engagement we've had with so many of our investors throughout the year. We appreciate the opportunity for an open and honest dialogue.
Well, that again is Darren Woods, CEO of Exxon, from that shareholders meeting. He's being maintaining his decorum there. But again, what was happening was anything but run-of-the-mill. And Charles Penner joins us now. Again, he's one of the principals at Engine Number One. Charles Penner, welcome to On Point. What is the change that you were talking about trying to execute at the shareholders meeting?
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me. I mean, I guess it's really just to start responding to a changing industry and a changing world. I mean, the main trends that drove the campaign were the changing economics of the oil and gas industry, the impact of technology on the oil and gas industry, and the impact of global efforts to decarbonize. And in our opinion, none of those are simple problems, but at a minimum, we felt like, you know, board of directors of an oil and gas company needed people on the board with successful and transformative energy experience who have profitably looked around corners in the industry before to help them actually start moving forward on all of those issues, as opposed to what we viewed as an overly kind of inert position with respect to those issues.
Yeah. So you really are actually trying to change the direction of this storied and historic oil and gas company here. And you got two, possibly a third, board member elected here. Were you? I mean, this has been some time in the making. But how do you feel about the fact that possibly three quarters of your slate actually made it onto the board?
Good. I have my background is in traditional shareholder activist campaigns that are typically focused on capital allocation and capital structure and more kind of quotidian things. But, you know, even just looking at this on a very kind of straightforward, blinders-on basis, you know, Exxon was you know, a sensible company to focus on, you know, given recent performance. The added factor of, again, in our opinion, a failure to kind of think longer term about how to gradually and pragmatically start repositioning the business for the future, you know, gave it an additional layer. But, you know, even from the outset, just looking at it, you know, solely on the basis of past performance, during a decade in which, you know, oil and gas demand was growing, it felt like a company that was ripe for change. And certainly, you know, the industry is not going to get any easier as time goes on. So we felt like, you know, had a good chance to succeed.
Well, so let's put some shape to that lackluster performance you're talking about. I mean, Exxon got dropped off the Dow a while ago. Debt growing, at least ninefold, almost $10 to $60 billion. Interestingly, I'm seeing analysis that a third of that debt, the growth in that debt, going to prop up dividends for shareholders, which is kind of not a great sign. And then Exxon having written off $17 billion of assets because of some bad purchases they made. So I can see what you mean by possibly a good target here. But here's the thing, though, Charlie. Just to let listeners know, Engine Number One, this hedge fund that you're one of the principals of, it was founded just last fall. And do I have this right? Specifically to address issues of climate on corporate boards.
Not quite.
Okay.
I'll try to make this quick.
Yeah.
Engine Number One is actually, there is a hedge fund business within it. There's a shareholder engagement business, which is the one that I run. There's a broader public market business. There are private investments, which actually right now are the largest part of the firm. So it's more than just a hedge fund. And with respect to the goals of the firm, you know, it's really, at least the way I think about it, is that, you know, companies that think long-term will perform better over the long-term. So that's everything from your relationship with your customers, with your employees, with society. And in this case, with the planet, but all with the focus on, if you're thinking short-term, you might act one way. But if you're focused on the long-term, which at least most large, you know, institutional investors today are, you'd be taking all of those things into greater consideration and factoring them in to your kind of long-range business planning. So that's the kind of unifying theme here.
Well, so let me put a little more emphasis on what you're saying. You're saying that it's essential, it's an existential need for the planet, but also for Exxon in this particular case, its very existence as a business.
Yeah, look, I mean, we all know it's an existential need for the planet. We don't add a whole lot to that. I think that's fairly well fleshed out. You know, what we're trying to do is, you know, draw the connection to those larger concerns that I think we all have and the investment case. I mean, that's what we can bring to this that's different. And making the argument that, you know, even if you just leave your investor hat on, as long as you're thinking about it from a long-term perspective, look, if you're only concerned about the next few quarters, you're not going to care, right?
Yeah.
And in our opinion, you know, that was too much of the focus on Exxon, which leads you to the conclusion that you invest incredibly heavily, even in lower-term projects to jack up production growth, and, you know, don't really do the hard work of figuring out how you can even kind of gradually and pragmatically start to diversify the business, because there's not going to be a short-term payoff to that.
Yeah.
And if you catch the right side of the upcycle, you know, like they are now, there's going to be a short-term payoff to, you know, having invested heavily in a lot of otherwise, on average, low-return oil and gas projects from return on capital employed perspective, rather than just focusing on your best assets.
Right. Well, let me just jump in here for a second, Charlie, because just to remind folks, Engine Number One owns a fraction of a percent of Exxon stock, so not enough on its own to make any changes to the board in a vote. How it happened, though, was that Engine Number One got the support of three of the biggest pension funds in the United States: the California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, the California State Teachers Retirement System, and the New York State Common Retirement Fund. And Aisha Mastagni joins us now. She's portfolio manager for the California State Teachers Retirement System. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So tell me, give me a quick summation of the story of how Engine Number One and Charlie and their group convinced the California State Teachers Retirement System to throw their votes behind this change.
Sure. Well, let me start by just telling your listeners, CalSTRS, at CalSTRS, we uphold a century-long promise to serve the retirement needs of almost a million educators and their families. And we do that by being a responsible fiduciary, and we're a diversified global investor, and we're trying to create long-term shareholder value for the teachers of California. And so when Charlie and Engine Number One approached us with this idea, we perked up and listened because we'd had a long engagement with Exxon that yielded very little results. And we had grown frustrated with the myriad of underperformance issues at this company.
Some of the underperformance issues we talked about a minute ago here. So I get that, but it's in, you could try to throw your support behind a different kind of a board member. The specificity of the idea that the board has to take the company in a different direction regarding climate change specifically is what I want to hear a little bit more from you about. Why was it that you decided was worth effecting change at Exxon about?
Well, this was a company that had a very a group of directors that, on paper were very, very successful and accomplished individuals. There's no doubt about that. But what it lacked was some very specific skill sets that we felt were necessary to make this a more resilient company in the future. And those skill sets, some of which Charlie just touched on, one, it lacked anyone that had any real industry expertise in oil and gas. It didn't have anyone on the board that had any regulatory or policymaking experience. And like Charlie said, we needed individuals that had successful track records in industries in transformation.
Yeah. Aisha, if you stand by for just a second. Charlie, I know I'm technically supposed to let you go now, but I have two more questions for you. Can you stick around for just five more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the remarkable shareholders meeting for ExxonMobil. And it's not necessarily the meeting that deserves our focus, but the change on the board of directors for Exxon, where a group has managed to put several new board members on whose focus is in transforming one of the world's largest energy companies with a mind towards a climate change future. Charlie Penner joins us. He's a member of the hedge fund Engine Number One, which was behind this change. And Aisha Mastagni joins us as well. She's the portfolio manager for CalSTRS, the California State Teachers Retirement System, one of the huge pension funds that threw its vote behind this change at Exxon. And Charlie Penner, just two quick questions. It's not just sort of people who were focused on climate that you put forward on this slate here. They weren't necessarily activists in and of themselves. As Aisha said earlier, you were also looking for leadership with experience in the sector. So can you tell us just quickly about a couple of the board members that did make it onto the board?
Yeah, all four of them are some of the most amazing people I've ever met in my life, and they're all willing to do this basically just because they thought they could help, and these were people who could pretty much do anything. The two right now who've been voted on, and we still got our fingers crossed for the third, the first is Greg Goff, former CEO of Endeavor. as good a credentials as you can get in the oil and gas industry, and we feel like you know, it's important that the business be run well so that it can invest in the future. And obviously, you need to be able to have things going well to be able to think strategically about the long term. So I think Greg's really important to, you know, be helpful to the board there. Kaisa Haitalia, one of the most impressive people I've ever met in my life. She did a transformation of an oil and gas company from the inside called Neste. She, with an initial $25 million investment, built what is today the largest renewable diesel and jet fuel business in the world, created about $35 billion in market cap that accounts for today about 90% of that company's profits. And, you know, she did it with that company's existing resources and skill set. So not to say that Exxon necessarily would do the same thing, although they've been trying to build the biofuels business for about 10 years now without any success. But that type of, you know, understanding we think is so transferable to, again, helping the board oversee management, whose responsibility is to come up with these ideas. And the third, we've got our fingers crossed for Andy Karsner, brings the regulatory experience that Aisha was talking about, but also is one of the leading folks in Silicon Valley on issues like carbon capture and smart grids, which will be hugely important for, you know, countries like India and things as they figure out what path they take on the energy transition, the intersection of AI, machine learning, and natural resource development. He does all that today, leading strategy at X, formerly known as Google X, which is the moonshot laboratory of Alphabet. So none of those people will be recreating what they've done in the past, but they obviously have, we think, highly transferable skill sets that can help Exxon as it undertakes, you know, the biggest challenge in business world today, which is figuring out how to move a company like that gradually into the future.
Now, Exxon spent tens of millions of dollars to try to thwart this effort. Obviously, it didn't fully succeed. So, Charlie Penner, does Engine Number One have its eye on other companies next?
Yeah.
Who?
We do. Well, I would hate to spoil the surprise. But I mean, I will say that they should not all be this contentious. You know, my prior firm where I worked, Jonah Partners, we had one proxy contest in 20 years. And in most cases, you should be able to figure out something with a company that you know, moves in the right direction with it without this type of you know, these types of things. So our hope is that the next one will be a little quieter.
Well, Charlie Penner is a member of the hedge fund Engine Number One. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Aisha Mestaghni, Charlie mentioned that the next proxy fight may not be this contentious. I just want to get a sense of how contentious it was. So first of all, here is Exxon CEO Darren Woods, who went on CNBC after the vote last week. And he was asked whether Exxon shareholders want the company to start addressing climate change. And if so, how would he respond? And here's what he said.
Over the past several months, we have been very actively engaged with our shareholders, sharing our plans and hearing their viewpoints and the key issues of importance to them. You know, with over 3 million, almost 3 million shareholders, it's not surprising we've got a pretty wide range of views that were expressed.
Okay, so let's hear some of that wide range of views. The chief investment officer of Christian Brothers Investment Services at the meeting accused Exxon of not coming clean with shareholders about what a coming decline in demand for oil and gas would mean for Exxon's bottom line.
The new net zero by 2050 scenario and report shows that gas demand will decline by 55% and demand for oil by 75%, with no new investment in oil and gas fields necessary. This is our company's bread and butter, yet Exxon has not agreed to disclose to investors what a potential significant decline in demand will do to its financials.
Also at that same shareholders meeting, on the other end of the spectrum, pushback against the activist shareholders.
These activists hate our business and our country and have no use for us. This year, I propose that Exxon push back on climate idiocy by disclosing the actual costs and benefits of cutting emissions. The costs of the cuts, you see, are very high and the benefits are zero. But the ever-obtuse Mr. Woods refuses to acknowledge these realities. Instead, he fantasizes about appeasing the crazed political radicals who are the mortal enemies of us genuine shareholders.
Aisha Mestaghni, you were at the meeting. What was it like?
You know, it was probably one of the most unusual AGMs I've ever been to. I've never been to a meeting where there was an unplanned hour recess. I have never been to a meeting where there wasn't the typical business portion where we run through all of the various items on the proxy and then the polls are closed. And then there's usually a question and answer period. I think the polls were open for almost 3 hours over the course of the morning.
Is CalSTRS, as that one shareholder said, a group of crazed political radicals, the mortal enemies of genuine shareholders?
You know, we at CalSTRS, like I said at the top of the hour, you know, we have an obligation to the beneficiaries of our fund, which are the California educators. And we're a global diversified investor, and we use our portfolio to provide a secure retirement to those teachers.
Well, let's bring in Andrew Logan now. He's senior director of oil and gas at the nonprofit Ceres, which works with the private sector to address environmental and sustainability issues. Andrew, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we're focusing on Exxon now, but in the broader context of the energy sector, how significant was this proxy fight over the board for this one company?
This was huge. I mean, it really was a landmark in the history of investor engagement with the oil and gas sector. You know, I think it will really accelerate change that is very overdue. I mean, nothing focuses the mind of a corporate director like the possibility that they might lose their job. And last week at Exxon, that risk became very real. So I think we'll see the impact of this vote really reverberate well beyond Exxon to the rest of the sector.
Okay, so let's explore that a little bit more, because we should make it clear that the primary thing that a board can do is exactly what you said: hire and fire the company's CEO. Which is significant. But beyond that, can the board, or can a change in the board, more deeply impact the direction of the business?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we shouldn't shortchange the importance of the role of overseeing the CEO, because I think, you know, at ExxonMobil in particular, the strategy is really intertwined with the persona of Darren Woods. And so I think there is a very real question as to how long, you know, he's going to remain at the helm there. But I think the board also has, you know, a really important role in asking hard questions about the company's strategy. I think what has been so problematic about the board at Exxon over the years is not just sort of who has been on it and whether they have the right skills or background, but the fact that it's really been a board that has not, you know, seemingly been willing to challenge management's thinking and you know, hasn't been willing to listen to outside voices. And certainly, you know, we get one hopes that these new board members will both, you know, on their own be willing to bring in outside perspectives, but will, you know, will lead their fellow board members to want to do the same. Because, you know, part of the issue with ExxonMobil is that it really has become isolated over the years. I mean, really, you know, the world has changed around this company, and yet Exxon, you know, largely has remained standing in place.
Isolated, but specifically how? In terms of its focus on oil and gas and not moving at least meaningfully in the direction of renewables? What do you mean?
No, exactly. You know, I think if you go back a decade, there wasn't a lot of daylight between, you know, ExxonMobil and its peers in the oil and gas sector, or even the sectors that ExxonMobil services, you know, the power sector or the automotive sector. You know, they certainly they talked differently about climate change as an issue. They were, you know, unhelpful in all sorts of ways in their involvement in the science and in the public policy conversation. But, you know, they were an oil and gas company, just like, you know, BP and Shell were oil and gas companies. But, you know, fast forward to the present and you see, you know, the company's peers, you know, really pivoting in many ways to clean energy. You see the power sector, you know, rapidly decarbonizing and moving away from natural gas. You know, you see Ford introducing an electric version of the F-150. You see the six largest banks in the U.S., you know, all committing to decarbonize their lending portfolios. And, you know, these are banks that Exxon really relies on for capital to run its business. So, you know, the world has changed monumentally, and yet Exxon is still plowing, you know, 99.99% of its capital, you know, into oil and gas.
Uh-huh. Now, Aisha Mastagni, if I understand correctly, what engine number one wants from Exxon is to pledge to reduce its emissions to net zero by 2050. And, you know, as Andrew was saying, changing its capital allocation to invest more, obviously, in renewables, amongst other things. But I'm seeing here that CEO Darren Woods said as recently as Thursday of last week that engine number one doesn't really have a plan for the business. And he claims they've been focused on, quote, perceptions of the past. What do you think about that?
I think the important thing here to focus on is that the campaign itself has focused on the underperformance issues that led the company to where it is right now. And its shareholder value was impeded by an undisciplined capital allocation, misaligned incentive structures, and the absence of a strategy to compete in a decarbonizing world. Engine number one and CalSTRS have been focused on those three issues throughout the campaign.
Mm. Well, there are some analysts I'm seeing here, Pavel Molchanov, who was quoted in the Washington Post. He's with Raymond James. He basically said that adding members to Exxon's board, that it's unlikely that it would transform the underlying business. He says it's highly doubtful. But coming back to the point that Andrew Logan was making, what about the future of CEO Darren Woods himself, Aisha? Would you like to see him no longer leading the company?
That's not really my job as a shareholder or an investor. My job is to make sure that I have the best collective group of individuals inside the boardroom that can oversee management and oversee strategy. And it's really up to those individuals to determine who the best person is to lead ExxonMobil.
Mm. This was quite a risk, though. This was a big risk for CalSTRS, right? Because it could have blown up in your faces, to put
Absolutely.
It bluntly.
Absolutely. You know, from the beginning, you know, we picked this company specifically because we had a history of engagement that all our other tools that were available to us that really could effectuate change had failed. And so when engine number one brought this idea to us to actually change the board, it was intriguing because we thought in order to really make a change at this company, it needed to start at the top and it needed to start with the board.
Mm. Now, I imagine that CalSTRS has investments with other major firms as well, of course. I mean, you're pretty sizable as one of the top three pension funds in the United States. As I asked Charlie Penner a few minutes ago, I'm going to ask you, with this victory regarding change on the board of Exxon, are you more amenable to trying to do the same with other energy companies that you're invested in?
We remain engaged with our portfolio companies, and we take our stewardship responsibilities very, very seriously. You know, we feel like we have an obligation to ensure that the companies in which we invest are accountable to its shareholders, and we do that through proxy voting and through engagement. This type of targeted and heightened engagement, you know, we only take it to this level when other tools that we have available to us have failed.
Mm. Well, Aisha Mestagni, portfolio manager at CalSTRS, the California State Teachers Retirement System, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Andrew Logan with Ceres. What is the first challenge for the two, possibly three new board members here? Because what engine number one is asking Exxon to do and trying to force them to do through this board change is take a longer view, first of all, about how the business practices of the company. Is that going to be aligned with the very interests of the shareholders who may have helped them in this vote?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly the, you know, the directors have a lot of challenges ahead of them. And in many ways, I think of the election last week as really the beginning of the process instead of the end of the process, right? We have fresh faces and fresh perspectives on the board. And now the challenge is to demonstrate that they can, you know, they can persuade their fellow board members to their way of thinking, which is not a foregone conclusion by any means. You know, this is a hard company to change, as any of us who've dealt with them over the years know very well. And so I think there is, you know, the first step for these directors is to, you know, is to sort of win over their fellow directors, you know, to this idea that, you know, for an oil and gas company like ExxonMobil, you know, that thriving in a decarbonizing world requires a real, you know, material shift in strategy. And so, you know, I think we'll begin to see whether this effort is bearing any fruit as we head into the fall. You know, every year, you know, each of the big oil and gas companies releases their capital budget. Basically, where is Exxon going to put the $20, $25 billion that it invests every year, you know, over the coming 12 months? And if next year's capital budget looks a lot like last year's, you know, then we know that we have a long way to go in turning this company around.
Hang on for just a minute, Andrew. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In our next episode, in our series about Amazon that we're calling The Prime Effect, it's coming next week, we will discuss Amazon's marketplace, that virtual store where more than 5 million sellers offer products to Amazon customers, most likely, or maybe even you. And we're looking to hear from small business owners directly. Whether you sell on Amazon's marketplace or just compete with them, we want to know, how has Amazon affected your small business? So go to onpointradio.org, and we've got a survey for you there about how Amazon has affected your small business. That's for the next episode of our series that we're calling Amazon, The Prime Effect. It's coming up next week. Now, today we are talking about what people in the business industry are calling a seismic change on the board of directors for ExxonMobil, where a group of activist investors who are focused on helping the company transform in the era of climate change managed to get a couple of new board members on in what was quite a remarkable proxy vote, a fight even. And I'm joined today by Andrew Logan. He's senior director of oil and gas at the nonprofit Ceres, which works with private sector businesses to address environmental and sustainability issues. And Andrew, let's listen to a little bit of what Eric Gordon, who studies corporate governance at the University of Michigan's Business School, says. He told us that what happened to Exxon is, in fact, reverberating across the energy sector.
It's a warning to other companies that play a big part in climate change. The warning is, okay, so far, you have defeated all of the important resolutions. You get to, you know, report to shareholders, oh, we're moving really fast, but you have set the pace. This is a warning that somebody else who doesn't like your pace might end up on your board of directors.
And Gordon says part of the key to engine number one's success is how they made their case for the need for change on the board.
It wasn't a bunch of unemployed candle makers and rubber dinghies attacking super tankers. It took a very reasonable sounding position, which is, look, we're going through a transition period. And in the transition period, you don't want to be putting more of the corporation's investment into what you're transitioning out of.
That's Eric Gordon, who studies corporate governance at the University of Michigan. Well, joining us now is Phil Verleger, owner of the energy consulting firm PK Verleger LLC and a senior fellow at the Washington think tank, the Niskanen Center. Phil, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
You heard Eric Gordon there a second ago. Do you think this is a warning to other companies that play a big part in climate change in the energy sector?
Absolutely. I mean, and 10 years ago, IBM celebrated its centennial with a two-page ad in the Wall Street and a number of other papers. And the headline read, "Nearly all the companies our grandparents admired have disappeared." Hmm. And it went on to say these companies were unable to simultaneously manage their business of the day and to build their business of tomorrow. Now, I've been following the oil industry for 50 years, so I guess I'd qualify as a grandparent if I had grandchildren. And Exxon, Shell, BP, Chevron are all going to vanish or essentially be unimportant within 20 years. And very few people will know what they are. And I really, you know, Charlie Penner was exactly on point. You know, Exxon's financial performance has been terrible. It's been terrible because they continue to invest in oil and gas and because they believed that the world demand was growing. And, you know, if you go back, these firms were formed more than 20 years ago when everybody believed that oil was going to be harder and harder to find and more expensive. So we need bigger and bigger firms. And, you know, really, I wrote a paper about this. These firms are too big to succeed. They're just too large. They're dinosaurs, and they need to shrink dramatically. I don't think that they are going to be any good at really facilitating the transition. They need to shrink. And BP laid out in last September a scenario where we go to net zero. They pointed out we need additional oil and gas development for a while, but we need to go to the transition. But these companies have no skills in renewables that Ørsted and other companies have. They have a bad record of doing other things. Exxon had office systems. Exxon's trying renewables. The only thing that they can do that really would help is develop a better way to sequester oil and gas or CO2 emissions into wells. They've been good at pulling oil and gas out. They can put it back in. And with blockchain and with commodity markets, we could develop a good, really good market for sequestering and maybe even get to net zero before 2050.
So, but Phil, let me ask you a quick question. And Andrew, I'm going to want to hear you on this. Is Exxon a special case within that that quartet that you just mentioned, Phil, of Exxon, Shell, BP, Chevron? Because, for example, the International Energy Agency just recently released a report with this global roadmap to net zero emissions and said that with this roadmap, there would be no need to invest in exploration for new oil and gas. But Exxon also seems to be saying that they're pointing to previous IEA estimates that at least sometime in the past that some $12 trillion of investment would needed to generate the oil and gas needed for supplies that would be demanded by 2040. So what's really going on here, Phil?
Well, sadly, you know, I've read this IEA report and it can only be described as a fairy tale. It's a scenario. But when you dig into the pieces of it, there's nothing there. There's one page at the end. They call for total international cooperation, a collaboration, lending to other to developing countries and so on. At the end, page 189, there's a one page where they point out that, gee, if we don't get this collaboration, we don't get to net zero until 2100 at the end of the century. But they didn't talk about this at all. And they also, when you read their price forecast, they say, well, prices will be about $25 a barrel in 2030 and going down. It's a fairy tale. Sadly, it's a distraction. I mean, Exxon's right. But I'd go back to the BP. You know, I was offered a job as an economist there. They used to have, I'm an MIT economist, a number of MIT economists there. They don't have any anymore. BP hired a really smart economist from the Bank of England, and they put together a very good analysis of the thing carefully. It's going to be wrong, and laid out how you could get there and laid out how much investment was needed. And they put the numbers behind it, whereas the IEA hides everything behind the screen. And if you look at the BP now, you need more investment. You don't need the amounts that Exxon said, but you do need some to have the transition. Otherwise, we run into the risk of having what we're seeing now in the auto industry and everything else, a chip shortage. We don't have enough manufacturing capacity to produce chips. Yeah. But I mean, my bottom line on Exxon is the people live on a silo, and they've just gone down deeper and deeper into that silo. They don't talk to anybody else. And so I really hope Andrew's right when he says that they listen to the new board people. And Jeff Goff, who they put on, the engine number one put forward, would be a wonderful transitional CEO because he has done amazing things with Tesoro, which became Endeavor. And he knows the oil and gas. He came out of ConocoPhillips, and he knows the transition issues. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to happen.
Well, Andrew, Logan, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I think it's hard to be too cynical about this industry in general and this company in particular. So I'm not sure that I would disagree with anything that Phil said. I would maybe would add a little bit of context. I mean, with the IEA report, maybe I'd be slightly more charitable and call it, you know, I think that report was a call to action. I think it laid out just, you know, what sort of how challenging it's going to be to sort of reach a net zero endpoint for the global economy and you know what that means in terms of investment in oil and gas. In a way, it sort of, you know, brackets the conversation in a really helpful way. And you know, I agree as well that, you know, everything that is said about the future of energy is going to be wrong. I think the challenge if you're an oil and gas CEO is to think about, you know, what happens when you're wrong, because you will be wrong, and sort of how do you prepare for as many possible futures as you can. I mean, and Phil mentioned, you know, BP and their, you know, their chief economist, Spencer Dale, you know, I heard him sort of talking once about sort of what turned his mind on this need to really take a more aggressive approach to shrinking the oil business at BP and preparing for a low carbon transition. And he said, you know, he began to understand that, you know, the economic impacts of climate change, if we don't address it, are going to be profound and profound in a really negative way. And I think what he understood was that the sort of scenarios that Exxon spins out and that the IEA used to spin out of a world demanding ever more energy, you know, they sort of can't come true, because if we head in that direction and, you know, we end up, you know, using a lot more fossil fuels and driving climate change to unmanageable levels, that's going to hurt the economy in ways that make it unlikely that we're actually going to need that much energy to begin with. So it's, you know, the sort of future Exxon is planning for, in a way, you know, contains the seeds of its own demise. And I think that's the sort of siloed thinking, the blinkered thinking that, you know, troubles a lot of observers about Exxon.
Okay, so let's listen to how another one of these massive companies is thinking, specifically Royal Dutch Shell, because here's CEO Ben Van Beurden, who spoke with Axios business reporter Hope King, and let's listen to this particular exchange.
At what point do you think Shell will make more than 50% of its business from clean, green energy?
I think that will probably be somewhere the next decade. Yeah, I would imagine.
More than 50%.
If we do not make that type of process by the middle of next decade, we have a problem, not just as a company, but as a society.
Andrew, Logan, Van Beurden there put a number on it that Shell, huge Shell, would, in the next decade, try to make 50% of its business from clean energy. It's something he can say now, but are they actually making business decisions to move in that direction?
Well, that, I mean, that's what investors will be looking to. And I think that's, you know, there's been a lot of, so I'd say two things. You know, one, there has been a real movement in the last year or two of companies like Shell and BP, but also others like Equinor and Total, you know, setting real targets around how much and how fast they're going to grow their investments in clean energy, which is welcome. And I think there's also been some concern from investors that those targets not be too far off in the future, because in a decade Ben Van Beurden may not be there at the helm of Shell to be held accountable. But I think compared to a couple of years ago, we can point to companies in this sector, however imperfect they may be in their plans, who are, honestly trying to make a pivot to a different kind of business. I mean, I think, Phil raises some interesting points about whether they have the skills and capabilities to make that leap. But mm-hmm. I think they have to try.
Well, but Phil, isn't it worth having at least a healthy dose of skepticism when CEOs of these companies right now say, yep, we're going to do something 10 years, 50%. It could be a kind of greenwashing to stave off the very activism that has befallen Exxon.
Absolutely. It's an absolutely correct point. I think Shell is a little different. They have been talking about this for a while. The trouble is, when they hire people to try to bring this in, the people stay for a few months and then move, then leave. I mean, Shell had several good people. But Shell is going to be pushed this way. Last week, the real momentous decision, I think, was not the Exxon decision, but a Dutch court ordered Shell to achieve a much larger cut. I think it's 47% in its emissions by 2030. Now it's going to be appealed, but I suspect they'll lose on the appeal. And so that the courts are going to pressure these companies. And Shell has made an effort. The problem is, and Andrew knows this better than I do, the returns, the costs are falling so dramatically every year for all the renewable energy sources, solar and others. There's been an uptick recently, but that it's hard to move into this business and make the kinds of returns the companies have made in oil and gas. And so I go back to this IBM statement. I think we're going to see the companies try, and they will become small players. But I mean, you can go back to the 40 years to Gulf Oil, which is a big company in Pennsylvania, one of the majors, developed in the Middle East. Boone Pickens forced them into the hands of Chevron with a takeover move like engine number one. Today, there's a Gulf Oil. It's in New England, but it's a tiny company. Huh. That is the future that is facing Shell, Exxon, Total, Equinor, and others. Yeah, as we go out, as fossil fuels move away, because they're just not adept and not as quick and they don't have the skill set that is really needed to get us to net zero. And we shouldn't ask them to. We should ask them to kind of quietly go work down and shrink rather than just blow up the way, say, Eastman Kodak blew up.
Yeah. Well, Andrew Logan, we have 1 minute left here. And one thing I didn't mention earlier is we focused on the role that CalSTRS and CalPERS and these huge pension funds played. But if I have the story straight, Vanguard, State Street, Fidelity, even BlackRock used their power, their votes, to affect this board change as well. I mean, that seems pretty remarkable to me that we had a lot of sort of private managers lining up here too.
It is remarkable. I mean, these are funds that are by their nature are very conservative. I mean, they are largely, what are called index funds, passive investors. They just own the whole market. And so they're going to own ExxonMobil as long as the company exists, or at least as long as it exists in a form, big enough to be part of the S&P 500. And so, they have a history of really trying to move companies, slowly over many years. And I think what we saw last week was that even these very large investors, these very patient investors, ultimately are running out of patience.
Well, Andrew Logan is Senior Director of Oil and Gas at the nonprofit Ceres, which works with the private sector to address environmental and sustainability issues. Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Phil Verleger, owner of the energy consulting firm PK Verleger LLC. Phil, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.